Peter Anastas has been part of my life from before I can remember. And I've always known him to be an incredible writer, a civic presence like few others, and an educator in almost everything he does. Dogtown College is something I've heard about around the periphery of my existence, and I'm very excited tonight to finally hear what it was all about, because it's a sort of legendary thing in my mind that I've heard about, that it existed, that this wonderful grassroots organization was here. And I mean, I use the term organization not having any idea what kind of organization it was, but we will by the end of the night. So I'm very happy to have Peter Anastas here to talk about Dogtown College. So without further ado, Peter.
Thanks so much. This isn't going to be a talk or a lecture. I'm thinking of it as a kind of an exercise in collective memory. And I'm just thrilled to have Kay and Martin Ray here tonight. Martin has written the best history that you will ever read of Dogtown College on his marvelous blog, Halibut Point. It's a wonderful so be sure to go to Martin's blog, which you should be reading. If you don't get it, you should be getting it regularly, because it's one of the great both literary and naturalist experiences that you can have in Gloucester. And Kay was a major force in Dogtown. She's listed in the histories as the treasurer, but she actually ran the operation. At any rate, what was Dogtown? What was Dogtown College? I think it's very important to give a little on the sense of the social, political, and cultural context. Dogtown College came out of so much of the countercultural thinking and praxis of the 1960s. Those of us who were involved in it had been inspired by some of the new educational thinking at the time. John Holt's books on education, which Peter knows very well, Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. These were extraordinary books. People were beginning to think about education in different kinds of ways. They not plant school. Schools, in a sense, in America. Michael Rummaker said to me, the first time that I met him, when he started coming to Gloucester after Charles Olson's death, he said, public schools, he said, they've become nothing but detention centers. There was this sense that something had gone wrong with both public and private kinds of education. Another key text was Theodore Roszak's The Making of a Counterculture. These were books that many of us who have been thinking about looking at alternatives in education were reading at the time. Herbert Marcuse's One Dimensional Man. We were looking at breaking down the earlier structures, the authoritarian structures, the capitalist structures. There was a tremendous need for alternatives, not only in education, but in politics, relationships, communities. And that's when you began to see the rise of free schools, cooperative schools, more homeschooling. And so what do we go back to? There were actually experiments here on Cape Ann, which I'll talk a little bit about. The Cape Ann Cooperative School, which a group of us started in the late 60s to teach our own children. In other words, we withdrew our children from public school. a group of us here in Gloucester, or our children didn't even start public school. My children didn't even start public school. My son, Jonathan, who was 50 years old, it tends to be a wag, said, "Well, Dad, we look back on those years of the Cape Ann Cooperative Schools." He said, "Dad," he said, "I didn't have a great life as a red diaper baby, starting this radical, starting this, you know, these, maybe some of these experiments were more to the liking of the parents, but I'll get back to that because the cooperative school was interesting, but there was a Cape Ann cooperative school, the Cape Ann Food Co-op, very very important counter institution, the Folklife Festival, all of these kind of events were spawned in this era, and Dogtown College. Well, what about the larger context? Looking at student radicalism in Europe and America, looking at the civil rights movement, looking at the anti-war movement, the free speech movement in Berkeley, these were all things that happened from the bottom up rather than from the top down. And one of the things we were all thinking about at the time was, how do we live this life from the bottom up? As a matter of fact, there was a whole school of history at the time looking at American history from the bottom up rather than from the top down. So what was the immediate background? Between 1962-63, we had conversations in Charles Olson's kitchen, at the kitchen table, speculative kind of conversations. Those of us who weren't aware of Black Mountain College, where Olson had taught and been a rector during, particularly during the last years, wanted to know from Olson what it was like. What was Black Mountain College like? As a community of learners and teachers who practiced their art. In other words, they weren't teachers who didn't do what they taught. They were teachers who did what they taught. And the students, whether they were going into art studios or dance studios or staying up half the night with Olson studying writing and literature, were involved with teachers in a community of learners and teachers. And we were thinking about that. And one of the things that Olson was talking about one night, I remember sitting at the kitchen table with Vincent Farini and Jonathan Bayliss, and Olson said, why don't we start a Free University of Gloucester? At the time, there were free universities beginning to appear in Europe, in Germany, in France, and later in Italy. Radical students would get together and they would call them universities without walls. People would gather in houses. They would gather in parks. They would gather in places not only to talk about things but to pursue studies that weren't taught in the established curriculum. So that was kind of the thinking about establishing a school without walls, a school where teachers and learners could participate in a community, a school that wasn't a school, a school where anybody who wanted to learn anything could find somebody to learn it with. And if you were ever to see, and I regret, one of the things that happens with these non-established kinds of organizations is there's not a great documentary history. we publish newsletters. I went tearing through the house to see if I could find any, without luck. But we published regular newsletters that listed the courses. We had sign up times during the year. We would list the courses that were being offered with little biographies of the facilitators. I'll get into the specifics of the classes in a bit. It was not the era of the iPhone or selfies and all that. I don't know who. I don't know who, if anyone ever took pictures. There are some, we know that Martin, in his wonderful history of Dogtown, has some pictures that were taken, I think, from what, the Gloucester Times and other media? that were of classes and events. So we don't have a huge documentary history, and maybe that's the way it should be. It was something that happened, that flourished, and that it ended when it was supposed to have ended. So that thinking that started with Olson and Black Mountain didn't die. It sort of continued. About some years later, Steve Himes, who was a physicist who'd done some really extraordinary work at Berkeley and Caltech, was living in Gloucester, and he and Jonathan Baylis. Jonathan Baylis was the controller of Gorton's. He was a novelist. He was the administrator of the city of Gloucester during Leo Alper. As mayor of Gloucester, and then became treasurer of the city of Gloucester. But Jonathan was educated at Harvard and Berkeley, an English major, a novelist who went into business because he believed that in order to write fiction about what was happening in America, you had to know something about business, because he felt that business was one of the major things that drove American life, American economy, American politics. So it was a big part of it. So Jonathan and Steve Himes were talking. And can you remember, Kay, about how this... do you have some sense from yourself about how...
I just remember that happened, and somehow you guys were at my house sometimes.
Yes, that's right. At the time, Kay lived on Rocky Neck.
That's
is that?
Right.
And
that's right.
And so much of this happened. Did you? Were you?
Joy.
I was. What's your sense?
A lot of meetings.
A lot of meetings. Yes.
Yeah, a lot of get-togethers.
A lot.
Josh Brackett was involved.
Yes, the personalities. Josh Brackett, who had a background very early on in computers and digital technology. So Steve was a physicist. Jonathan was a business administrator. I had been teaching previously at Tufts, and then I came back to Gloucester and was working at Action and teaching nights at North Shore Community College. Kay was... you were living on Rocky Neck at the time.
That's right.
You ought to mention the Clamshell Alliance.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. That was a huge piece of our background. Many of us had been involved in the fight against the nuclear power plant at Seabrook. And many of us were involved with the Clamshell Alliance. And that was one of the very local... protest and education organizations, along with the Cape Ann Concerned Citizens. I forgot to mention that, because that was just important. Cape Ann Cooperative School, Cape Ann Food Co-op, Folklike Festival, Dogtown College, the Clamshell Alliance, and pardon me? The Concerned Citizens, yes. The Concerned Citizens was very important. The Concerned Citizens was started by George and Alan Gaben, two artists who had moved to Rockport from New York. They had been involved in radical politics in New York. They had started, and it began as the Cape Ann Civil Rights Council. So in a sense, what's so interesting about all this to me, as I look back on it, national manifestations of protests and pressure for social and cultural and political change had their echoes on Cape Ann and in Gloucester. There were those of us who, like Peter, who'd been involved in anti-war activities in Cambridge.
Well, Olson said the macro is in the micro.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what we were thinking about, Peter, the macro being in the micro. And we were thinking, I mean, many of us had gone on the marches to Washington. We'd gone to the Poor People's March. We'd done a number of things like that. But somehow we wanted to bring it all home. And I can't say that I played a major role in this, because I came later. George and Allen Gaiman started the Cape Ann Concerned Citizens first as being involved in civil rights, and then protesting the war in Vietnam, and then getting involved in looking at more kinds of local change. Joe Garland was a major.
Yeah.
And pardon me.
I just remember being in his house. He was organizing people.
Joe.
Yeah.
Joe had been a union organizer in the newspaper business after the Second World War, and Joe and Vincent Farini were very close around these politics, labor politics, particularly Vincent's history in labor activism in Lynn before he came to Gloucester. So writers were coming together, artists were coming together, and so all of this, there was this ferment in Gloucester, out of which Dogtown College grew. And there were, as Joy said, there were a lot of meetings. We met at people's houses. How are we going to do this? What should we do? How will it work?
Food.
Oh yes, food was huge. We would have. Our fundraisers were all done at the basement of the UU Church. Chris Barton, this is a marvelous cook, had the first natural foods restaurant in Gloucester called the Garden of Eaton, E-A-T-I-N, and where Brown's Mall is now, in the back of Brown's Mall, and Chris would cook these incredible meals, and we would invite the whole community to come to these meals, and they would pay a certain amount, and we would have an event, we would have poetry readings, we would have music.
But everybody contributed. The whole group of us.
Yes.
Each of us made a certain amount of meals from one recipe, and we all did that recipe. So it's like five or six people making the same recipe, and we all brought them in, and it was incredible because it all worked.
See, this is fantastic. This is why
it's real community.
It was real. This is why I want to call this an exercise in collective memory. It can't be one person's memory. It has to. We have to draw on those who were involved in what you remember. See, I didn't quite put that together. I remembered Chris and the Garden of Eden, but I didn't remember that major piece where. The Moosewood, there you go, talking about alternative media. The Moosewood cookbook, which out of which most of us ate at the time. But you know, all that goes back. The other piece of it was the Whole Earth Catalog. All of us were very involved in trying to change our lives in one way or the other, whether it was educating our children, whether it was the way to live, whether it was political activism, whether it was education, all of those things. And they existed, you know.
Peter, could you hold up a picture of yourself?
Well, got hold of, yes.
It's on the back.
No, that's not me. That's Mark Alexander's. This is one document that I've salvaged from Dogtown College, which was called Dogtown, which was an anthology that the students from my writing class, which was called The Writing Voice, published together. All was handmade, hand printed, hand bound, and published and sold in Gloucester. I'll get to that in a minute. But thank you, buddy. But so anyway, out of all of these meetings came the fact that we figured, talk about structure and bureaucracy. We decided that we needed a board of directors. We decided that somehow there had to be some engine that we would have our courses free for all. But we needed to have a board of directors. And I remember the early board was Jonathan Bayless Kay, myself, Steve Himes. Nancy Goodman came on. Nancy Goodman was studying at Harvard at the time, and she was very much interested in alternative education. Bobby Gibb, who had would been the first woman to run the marathon. She was our lawyer. Bobby Gibb not only ran the marathon and was an artist, she was also an attorney. So imagine that. We started out with a lawyer, too. We actually put together, did we not, Kay, a what do you call those things? Bylaws, yes. We actually put together bylaws, and did we? We did incorporate. We incorporated as a 501c3. So talk about. We actually had a bureaucratic. We had a bit of a bureaucratic strike. We just figured we needed that. We needed. I mean, monies were coming in, not lots of money, and we were getting involved. With having people that we paid, not a great deal. To facilitate the courses and involved with fundraising. So we formed a board of directors and we formed a 501c3 nonprofit with the state of Massachusetts.
And you had a mission statement too?
We also had a mission statement.
So what, do you know what, can you tell us what that was?
I think I have something in here that says did you, your piece has something, Martin, your piece, did you have a mission statement? Hey, imagine that we can't even remember our mission statement. No, but I think essentially what it had to do with establishing a community of teachers and learners, establishing a school without walls, a community of teachers and learners, and also that... one of the purposes of what we were doing was to promote not only educational but social and cultural change.
The environment was listed there too.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Now, and not only that, but the courses were offered in environmental issues and studies. That was very early on. A number of people were very concerned about that. So if it's a school without walls, where do the classes take place? People's houses, church basements. There was a gallery in East Gloucester Square called A Thousand Hands, run by Jane Robbins, who was a Gloucester person, who was an artist. Where else? Where else do we have classes?
There was an artist that lived downtown. We used to go to his house. I can't remember his name.
You're absolutely right. There was an artist who lived downtown. There was an amazing experiment. Hartley Ferguson, and I wish he were here tonight because Hartley was also a big player in Dogtown. Hartley Ferguson lived on Fort Square, not far from where Peter once lived, and not far from Olson's house. And one of the experiments that we did in education. We had what was called a Charles Olson Marathon. We went to Hartley's apartment.
No, that was part of that.
You certainly were.
And it was wonderful.
It was extraordinary. We spent a whole night, didn't we? And part of a day, we spent a whole night.
It was wonderful.
And we read from Olson's poetry and Olson's prose. We talked about it. We ate. We left in the middle of the night and walked all over Gloucester to see the places that Olson had described, taking the books with us so we could read at those places. And it really went along.
Like a la Olson, because that's what you told us.
Yes.
About Olson, was that he would, you know, wander around Gloucester and come to your house at, you know, after midnight sometimes, 2 a.m, to wake you up, to get you up, because he had an idea.
He had an idea. 2 o'clock one morning, my ex-wife and I were in bed. We had kids. You know what it's like when you have kids. You're done for. You go to bed, you pass out. Bang, a knocking on the bedroom window. It's Olson. He had to come in. My ex-wife used to make Harvard beets. God knows, Harvard Beats, that, you know, I mean, a lot of people say, gee, that, you know, that's cafeteria food. At any rate, Charles was mad for Harvard Beats. And he insisted, every time he came to our house, he insisted that Gene make Harvard Beats for him. And So he got us out of bed one morning, and he had to have his Harvard beats, and he had to talk. And so here we were. We were staying up half the night with Charles talking as he ate his Harvard beets. But there were all of these kinds of things that were happening in Gloucester. You know, why does education have to happen from 9 to 5? Mm-hmm. Olson taught his classes at Black Mountain late at night some, or sometimes they went late at night or through the morning. And education happens in conversations on the street. It happens in public places. It happens everywhere. And so much of that was part of what we wanted to do. So what were the courses? Jonathan Bayliss had been reading Melville for 25 years. Jonathan Bayliss gave a series of seminars on the novels of Herman Melville. They were extraordinary. And people would sign up. These were the more formal courses. The course would go for 8 to 10 weeks. There would be a syllabus, believe it or not. Steve taught some courses
physics.
Understanding physics. You remember those courses?
I took that class.
Can you say a little bit about it?
It was over here in East Gloucester Square in a storefront. And we met for, I don't know, 8 or 10 weeks. And he was incredible explaining the basics of physics to all of us who've never... I mean, I'm an artist, so I had never had that strong science background, and it was really enlightening. And it was very meaningful as well, and he was able to explain terms, things, and make us all understand what...
Oh, it was extraordinary. Steve had this wonderful ability. I mean, he'd had an academic career. He'd been involved in a tremendous amount. Steve left research because he didn't like the direction it was moving in. He did not want to work on the military-industrial side of science. And he was a tremendous theoretician. He could explain particle physics. He could explain relativity, quantum mechanics. I mean, it was unbelievable. He would sit down with you and tell it to you in the clearest possible way, so that you really understood it. And Steve wrote a couple of really extraordinary books. And we were so lucky. Here we were, Gloucester, Massachusetts. People who come here today. Have no sense. They think, well, there's an art history here, there's a literary history, there's a history, the economic history in the fishing industry. They have no sense of who actually was living here. We had, Garrett Lansing had been living here since what, the 1950s, Garrett?
Late 50s.
Late 50s, and Garrett published a very important magazine from Gloucester, Set. Would you say it would be sort of published from Gloucester?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
59. And I think you were in Rome when Harry Martin had at his apartment Hug, the Free University of Gloucester, Jean Radoslavich,
yes.
Charles Vincent, Adolf Matz and his wife came, sometimes Paul Oakley, and I gave a sort of course in the imagination of nature in America. Mm-hmm. Walden and things.
This,
but I think you were in Rome.
I was living in Italy at the time, and this actually, when we were, and here, talk about, this is why this is an exercise in collective memory. What prompted those discussions at Olson's kitchen table in 62 and 63 was the Free University of Gloucester that actually happened in Harry Martin's apartment on Main Street in Gloucester, up above the pool room.
126
Main Street. So here we add to with Garrett. Thank you so much for that, Garrett. Here we add so that already had happened in Gloucester. So what else what else were we teaching or offering? Steve with physics, Jonathan Bayliss. Not only did Jonathan Bayliss give a seminar in the novels of Herman Melville. He also gave a seminar in the thinking of Alfred North Whitehead. So not to think that this was strictly intellectual. I mean, I'll talk about some, and maybe Kay can remember, and others, about some of the other kinds of courses. My interest was in writing, and I had taught English at Rockport High School, at Winchester Senior High School. I'd also taught in Italy, in Florence, at the International Academy, which was a private high school. And then I had taught at Tufts in the 1960s, and later at North Shore Community College. But the writing we taught was taught from a rigid point of view. And I didn't want to be working in that modality. So I offered a course called The Writing Voice. And let me read. We have an introduction. Let me read from the introduction to our anthology that came out of The Writing Voice. One of the goals of Dogtown College is to offer everyone on Cape Ann an alternative to traditional education. The Writing Voice was planned and conceived as an alternative to most creative writing courses, which I felt focused ultimately, and to my mind, reductively, on the creation of a literary product rather than on the actual writing process itself and on the very materials of that process, ourselves and our lives, our personal details, in the words of Charles Olson. As I saw it, the course would focus not on the making of literature, but on our need as people to express ourselves, to speak into the surrounding human world, the facts of our own existence, our personal histories, to say who we were and what we felt about the ways we were trying to find that out. In the places that it was happening, or had happened, on the very ground of that experience. I hope that joining together as a group, maybe eventually as a community, rather than simply as a class, or student and teacher, we might support and further the process in each other in a mutually cooperative effort of shared interests, energy, and concern. And that really, in some ways, was really the philosophy of Dogtown in every course that was offered, in every seminar. And I did The Writing Voice for a couple of years, and we had an incredible time. There were marvelous people who came, some who had never written before, some who had written, poet like Paul Coltrera, who then became a director of the Cape Ann Food Co-op, Ruth Ann Collinson, who was just starting to write at the time, Rufus, who became poet laureate of Gloucester. Hartley was in the course. Linda Johnson, who was Ruth Ann's sister. Josh Brackett was in the course. Mark Alexander, who was actually a photographer, was in the course. Hartley Ferguson was in the course. It was amazing. We also, those were the more, quotes, academic kinds of offerings. Now, Joy, you can help me with this, and maybe Kay. Did we not offer courses in, like, organic gardening? Did we not offer courses in, did Linda Crane not teach a course in seaweed?
I think she did.
Yes, in gathering and using seaweed.
Right. And there was a cooking class.
There was a cooking class.
And I taught a recycling class.
Oh. Can you imagine this, recycling that early? And go, yes.
Creating artwork from the recycling.
Artwork from the recycling.
Essentially making paper and prints.
Oh, yes. It was extraordinary.
When did you do the birthing ways?
What's about that time?
Yeah.
What was that?
Tell.
Well, a Anita Pandolfi went out to the Southwest at one point and came back with this Navajo tradition and started doing it around. She was a midwife. Anita was a midwife. I guess she still is. But people who are giving birth, we do a little ceremony with everybody, and it was called the birthing way. And it was just honoring the woman and honoring the process, you know, what she was going through, the birth. So making it.
I mean, that's really when you go from Whitehead and Malville to the birthing way.
Right.
This is so important though, because basic to what you're saying, I think, describing about education is, it's all experiential. We validate one's personal experience, whether it's giving birth to, you know, studying the kind of things you're just describing. And it was all going back to Dewey's experiential education as the foundation of American education. It validated your own personal experience. And you could not have a baby without somehow going through Joy's birthing way around here, and it was natural childbirth as well. It was almost like a rite of passage. Childbirth became a rite of passage in these ways.
We all were having home births at the time.
Home births. Yeah, our feeling was that life had become institutionalized, and we wanted to break through that. We wanted to break through it in terms of education. We wanted, I mean, I was, you know, I had come out of an academic background, and we didn't want to look at literature from a strictly academic background. What do books say to you? I mean, we'd all been through, you know, those of us who were in graduate school at the time, we'd been through structuralism, we'd been through French critical theory, we'd been through all of that stuff. What does a book say to you? How do you connect with a book? One of the things, Jonathan Bayliss, when he was reading Melville with his students, and Jonathan had a very strong academic background, but he was opening up Melville to the students in very, very, very different kinds of ways. In the same way that Steve was demystifying physics. When you go to school, I mean, you feel shut out from so much of the way of the kinds of teaching, and we wanted to break that down. We wanted to demystify it, and you know, somebody offered a course. This is unbelievable, but we had a woman who was a psychologist and who had studied the Bates method of training your eyes so that you did not need to use glasses. And Bates was what, a British doctor, was he not? Who involved, evolved, yeah,
yeah.
Was that right?
The Bates method.
Yeah, the Bates method.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a course was offered in it, and people took the course, and by God, they came through the course, and many, many people had learned the exercises and whatnot and didn't need to use their glasses. I mean, we thought, gee, I mean, you know, where are people going to learn things? Where can we find out things? If you want to find out things, how can you learn? We reached into the community to find people who could teach these things. Can anybody remember what, I mean, was there a tremendous range of things were offered? I can picture the newsletter, and Josh Brackett was wonderful because, you know, using computers at the time, I mean, I didn't, the only computer I knew was Jonathan Bayliss's computer at Gorton's, which was as big as this room. Josh would produce this newsletter, which was kind of like the curriculum, and it would show the courses that were being offered. Oh, didn't we ask people what they wanted to learn?
Yes.
We asked people what they wanted to learn, and then we found people to teach it, and we even did one-on-one kinds of things. I remember there was somebody who wanted to have some background in ancient Greek. And so I remember this person came to me, and I had studied Greek in college, and I was by no means a Greek scholar, believe me. But I sat down with this person over a series of weeks, and we looked at some grammar together, and we looked at some element. We read Xenophon, for example, which is always very easy to read, very clear. It's like, you know, when you study Latin in high school, you read Caesar. And so we sat down and did some of that. So there, a lot of that happened with languages.
I think you could mention urban renewal, even though it doesn't play directly, just in the background.
Yes.
The frustrations.
Well, I think that's also important because we saw the breakdown. Olson spoke out very strongly. Urban renewal came to Gloucester in the late 50s and early 60s. As you will remember, it was federally funded. It's been looked at very critically in the histories as removal of the poor from neighborhoods that wanted to be gentrified. It came to Gloucester. There were towns that avoided very, very positively. Newburyport avoided urban renewal. Salem, there was an extraordinary situation in Salem where the architectural historian Huxtable was so in love with Salem that she persuaded the city to reject urban renewal. There were a group of old ladies in tennis shoes, as they were described at the time, who fought urban renewal, and it did not happen in Newburyport. It did not happen in Portsmouth. It happened in Gloucester with a vengeance. They tore out a huge piece of the working waterfront. Olson called it renewal by destruction. And he wrote letter after letter after letter to the Gloucester Times talking about everything that's been taken away, he said, will be wanted back. And so we had that background about the fact that there was this loss of historical structures, this loss of infrastructure, this loss of huge pieces of the working waterfront. So there was an attempt somehow to repossess ourselves. And that's where Joe Garland came in and taught some local history, which was and talked about local history, which was extraordinary because Joe
Window on the Marsh.
Pardon me?
Window on the Marsh.
Well, window there, another very important, the first major environmental initiative in Gloucester. A group of citizens got together and saved that piece of the marsh from where the
Sudbys
outdoor theater was, through back and back of Sudbys. And didn't, I mean, people got together and raised the money, didn't they, Peter?
Mm-hmm.
And,
Smith.
Pardon me?
Wasn't Betty Smith?
Yes. Oh, Betty Smith was a huge factor in that. And these were folks, who had not been activists, but suddenly they began to realize what we've lost, a sense of loss permeated the community at the time. So that's a kind of a sense of how it started, and Garrett, I can't thank you enough because I mean all of us are getting to that point where it's hard to remember what happened the night before, or what you ate the night before, or whatnot. And it's hard to remember what happened.
A part of that campaign was to save the Fitzhugh Lane house, believe it or not.
Yes.
It was meant to be demolished along with all the rest of it.
That is right. It was meant to be demolished. Thank you, Martin. It was so important. They were going to demolish the Fitzhugh Lane house as part of urban renewal. If you can picture that part of Gloucester, there was a labyrinth of streets and houses down there in which working people and low-income people, people who worked on the waterfront, lived.
Like the fort.
And like the fort. It was just like the fort in the old days. And they were driven out. Public housing was built. Maplewood Park was built. Riverdale Park had been built for veterans. So Maplewood Park was built, and many, many of these people, their houses were taken away from them, and they were moved into public housing. I mean, if you look at the politics of that, I mean, it is excruciating to think about that. And we wrote, we Dogtown and the Food Co-op, all of you, and Cape Ann Cooperative School, the Folklife Festival, all of these institutions, these alternative institutions, rose out of a people's sense of what was lost, the sense of community being broken apart. Yes, Henry.
Peter, you know, there's another little piece of that that predates Dogtown College, but in 76, but it involved, you know, Jonathan, who brought, through the Carter administration, brought the Gloucester Arts and Humanities, and some of the documentation that occurred during that was pretty amazing.
Very important. Jonathan, one of the things Jonathan did when he was the administrator of the city of Gloucester, these were seated. Now talk about the WPA. And as an aside, this is just personal, but I think one of the greatest mistakes that Obama ever made as president is the first thing he should have done, becoming president in terms of that incredible economic downturn, was to reinstitute a WPA, and which was that we had it in the 70s as the CETA program, where artists went to work in the communities, where unemployed people were retrained. I mean, Obama talked about how Roosevelt had been such an inspiration to him, and to not think about reinstituting a WPA or CETA. I mean, that's real economic development in terms of but thank you for mentioning that, Henry. And I apologize for my aside. But that program, Jonathan Bayliss, of course, who had his mother had been a writer in the WPA, working on the state guide, to Massachusetts, and so Jonathan was a direct beneficiary of the WPA, and he remembered it, and he put an incredible program together, and that was documented, and Greg Gibson did an oral history, did he not, Henry?
He did some amazing oral history.
He did the bibliography.
Yes.
The Gloucester bibliography.
Greg did, under the CETA program, Comprehensive Employment and Training, what is it?
Act.
The Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. Just imagine, could this ever, I mean, just imagine today, could this ever happen? I mean, it's unbelievable. But under this, Greg did his bibliography of Gloucester, so there existed a bibliography of books, articles, and a continuation of the oral history that Peter and I did, which was happily funded by the city of Gloucester for the 350th anniversary of Gloucester, and it was a continuation of what we had started.
And all that stuff exists on CDs in the library.
And it's all exists on CDs in the library. So it's amazing. So
one other thing you might mention is Project Fish. Remember that, to save the Fishermen's Institute?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Probably 73.
Absolutely, it was very, very important. Mac Bell played a major role in getting people together to try. The Fisherman's Institute was on what's the name of the street?
Duncan Street.
On Duncan Street, but Duncan Street went all the way down to past what's now where the Fitz Henry Lane House is, and there were rooming houses, and then the Fisherman's Institute was a big 19th century brick building, and there was that, the police station, all of that was demolished in urban renewal, and so the fishermen and the Fisherman's Institute was an old time sailor's Bethel, a place where a maritime person could go and live in later life. And it was Peter did a lot of oral history in there. Would you talk a little bit about your experience here? Snug Harbor, yes, it was
It was that. I mean, fishermen who would be homeless today were able to find lodging there, and some kind of dignity, I hope, and again, it was...
It wasn't a shelter, was it? It was a real home.
Yeah, and it was right across from Alchemy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Which was, at the time...
Oh, we have to mention the glass sailboat. We can't forget Gloucester's first alternative business, starting as a head shop, pretty much. And then went into groceries and then into alternative medicinals and clothing imported from India. And actually, it was the first distribution point for the early days of the Cape Ann Food Cooperative. And it's amazing the picture that emerges.
Simon Geller's studio was above that.
Simon Geller's studio, Gloucester's own radio station. Think then of all this homegrown activity. Think of this sense of alternative community and communities that grew out of this period. So what happened?
Just one more point.
Please.
The Fisherman's Institute was probably the last building to be taken down in urban renewal.
Yes.
And why? What? For what reason? The parking lot. For the police
work. The parking lot.
Right, it was this gorgeous brick building. It was an extension of the Leventis building where Trident Gallery and the food and the went down along that side of the street.
There was an attempt, yes. And the parking lot became this very problematic in Gloucester. The Central Grammar School, which is now elderly housing, was going to be torn down by the city for a parking lot. And Action stepped in and asked the city to give it to them. And the city councilors wanted a good reason for this. And our current mayor and our new permanent mayor, Safathia, Romeo Taken's father, Enzo Giambanco, who was president of the board of directors at Action Incorporated, brought 500 people into City Hall one night to demand that Central Grammar be turned into elderly housing. And the city council gave Central Grammar to Action. Kirk Noyes, who was working at Action at the time, working out his a conscientious objector service at Action, and was an architect, trained at Washington University. He and Carmen Gorga, who was director of community development, Grace Musseri, a major force in forming what we call the United Fishermen's Wives of Gloucester, talk about alternative institutions, all came out of that, and that's how Central Grammar did not become a parking lot. And then Greg Gibson, when Greg was president, president of the Gloucester Historical Commission, and Leo Alpa was mayor, I was vice president. They wanted to tear down the GAR Hall on the corner of Washington and Gould Court for a parking lot next to the Maplewood School, because the city offices were in the Maplewood School, and Greg fought and preserved the GAR Hall. So there were things were, and in other words, there wasn't this sense of that everything was going to be lost to us. At any rate,
Kirk just got he's going to get started on the Maplewood School, where Joy used to quantity cook.
And Head Start.
Yes, the Maplewood School is now going to be housing, finally, after all of these years. So anyway, what happened to Dogtown? We've talked about how it began. How did it end? And what can we learn from the experience? Well, how did Dogtown end? Would anybody want to say anything about that? How and why did Dogtown end?
The registration, and you know, wasn't that a whole lot of work for just a couple people to do? And wasn't that the reason that it...
It became...
Administrative nightmare.
It became an administrative. I'm talking about bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. One piece was that it became difficult to administer. We had lots of students, lots of courses. We had monies. We had filings mm-hmm. every year for your 501c3, and also people had a sense that the purpose was fulfilled. That it was never going to be a permanent institution, that it was going to be something that grew out of a need in the community. It was going to, hopefully there would be spin-offs, and there were many spin-offs from Dogtown. And then between the more conventional pressures of running an institution and the sense that a purpose had been fulfilled, I remember the board suddenly got together, right, and said, right. We've done our job.
Right, I think that's what happened. And I think people sort of drifted off.
People drifted off.
I remember that.
People drifted off. The Cape Ann Food Co-op became a major force in the community, and many other sort of organizations. So what did we learn from the experience? What do you think? Start late 70s and went into the 80s, into the mid 80s.
I'm not good with those numbers,
but no, I was trying to remember the exact dates, but I think 78, 79 we put it together. It went well into the 80s. What do you think, Joy?
I remember doing a calendar, and I can't try to visualize the date of the calendar where all these photographers gave their work, and we created this thing.
Joy made a calendar that we sold to raise money
right.
for Dogtown. If we could find a copy of that calendar, we might have some sense. But I mean, but we weren't into permanence. We weren't into documenting what we were doing. We were into experimenting. We were all of us. We're going through changes to be in our personal lives, and what Dogtown enabled us to do was make some of those changes. It enabled people who wanted to do creative things to do them. It enabled people who wanted to learn things to do them. People who took courses in Dogtown went on to do more formal kinds of educational work. People that we were together with in the writing classes went on to publish and become writers. Yes, Martin.
Would you say that it's that an experience like that could give you compassion for institutions, for areas in the community where you do want to have longevity or perpetuity, and what that's grappling with, what our needs are, and how it can be attended to and supported or tolerated?
I think that's a terrific question.
You mentioned Jonathan going into business. At least you attributed that to one of his motives for going into business, to try to understand perhaps or contribute or draw from or something. So here we're talking, we're going to contrast the
yes.
Dogtown College experience with the possible need for more permanent kinds of
institutions in a community. What do you folk? What do people think? Yes.
Well, it sounds to me that the experience has allowed people to be able to envision other forms of community organizations, like the Gloucester Writers Center, and also what's going on with the Olson Library, to recognize there's a need in a time and place when books are being destroyed or libraries closing down, that Gloucester is starting a whole new library that's going to conserve, some of the great books of this community and the writers that came from here, and who knows what that will turn into. But
yes.
In addition to what Martin was saying about being wanting to attach ourselves to ongoing community organizations and institutions, is I just feel that people have a sense that that things can happen, that we can make things happen, that we can create things constantly based on the needs that exist by being in touch with people about those needs.
Are these not alternative institutions?
Of course.
The Writers' Center?
Yeah.
The Olson Library, the new Olson Library, did they not come out of the people's dreams and visions? They didn't. They didn't. It's not top down. The Writers' Center isn't top down. The Writers' Center is the dream, of Henry and Annie and you and the folks who wanted to create a kind of alternative institution where people could come together and learn and.
Connected to the writers and thinkers and activists of this community. Mm. It's not separate.
No, it's not separate.
In the past as well as the present.
No, I think very much so. There was someone who talked about those years in Gloucester when Olson was alive, and Gloucester being like another Concord. Writers, artists, thinkers, it's a huge piece of our history that needs to be written and reincorporated into the lives that we're having today. Are there any questions? Is there anything?
Here, I have a question. Question, observation.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the idea of micro, macro, and your sort of really wonderful, I mean, it reminds me and all of us of sort of going back and forth, looking at Dogtown College and then looking at what was happening in the nation, and you have the civil rights movement, and you have CETA, and you have all of these things going on, and what I think is really interesting, what happened at Dogtown College, which I had never heard of before, is that, I happen to be a product of progressive education, and the last 35 years I've been in progressive education, and also watching it disappear, and fragments of it being dropped in inefficiently into the public school system. And what's interesting is it seems to me what happened with Dogtown College is the progressive lack of ownership and the being involved in the process of learning and teaching together made it be a place where it wasn't quote unquote taken over. Because what happened to me in my educational teaching life is that I'll get involved in something that starts like Dogtown College, and then it gets taken over because the times change. And so I find it so sort of sociologically, politically, and economically interesting that Dogtown went poof, rather than somebody coming in and say, you know, we're going to turn this into an academy, we're going to turn this into something that's a moneymaker. Mm-hmm. It's happened three times in my life where a school has been taken over and become bureaucratic, hyper-traditional, and destroying anything that has anything to do with John Dewey. So I find this really interesting, and this makes it very rare piece of history, the educational history.
Well, I love what you're saying. We weren't taken over, were we?
No.
No.
We just sort of faded out.
We just sort of faded out.
Yeah, which in some ways preserves its effort.
Yes, we were faded out. We weren't taken over. Judy.
Well, I mean, Martin, that was a great question. And I mean, I think it goes back. My sense with institutions is that you get to when something's alive, it works. You don't have to go out banging the doors to get people to come to it. Right. You don't have to go out banging doors to get people to raise
No,
money.
We never banged
How
on any doors.
How many times have I been in an institution that spends its entire life trying to drum up trade, so it's really died a long time ago? You know, I mean, so I think there's something about that
no.
ties in with your question about, you know,
yeah.
is about institutions, Martin, you know, I mean, or empathy for them, or how do we move, or what do we do, or... Should they just go poof?
Yes, Dogtown came out of a need. It came out of a need in the community for people to get together to learn and teach. It came out of a tremendous need. There was that didn't happen in the community. Well, it happened at the Cape Ann Cooperative School when a bunch of parents got together. Mary Weisblum was a major force in that. Ray Bentley, all of us. I mean, Cape Ann Cooperative School was housed in Mary Weisblum's house for 2 years. At any rate, but these institutions came together out of need. Yes.
You know, you said something really poignant that really hit me, and you said it ended when it was supposed to end. And it's funny because I brought this little booklet with me. I don't know if anyone knows what open space is or agile. But open space is started with Harrison Owen. And what you are doing and what you did is practicing open space. And open space is a means of bringing together people from all different parts that partake in this happening. It's almost, and what comes out of it, in essence, it's grown up through technology groups now. And so it's called Agile. And the whole thing is about sustainability and thrivability in your life and how to be agile. And agile in, you can imagine, making a film or building software can be, people are going to kill each other. And it's built, so how do we function as a society? And open space brings that all together. And that's one of their things, is it ends when it's supposed to end.
When it's supposed to end.
It starts when, and if anybody wants to go on, there's actually there's lots of stuff online about open space. It would be really, they're doing an open space in Boston. They do it in Cambridge. It would be really
interesting. That's just fascinating.
They're in Boston.
I think another part of this that we need, rhymes with this or echoes off of this, like now, the things that are happening. Things that came out of the Occupy movement. There are a lot of free schools that came out of that, and as we just heard about, you know, the way some of these things can also take place in physical spaces, but also through sharing things
exactly.
in virtual spaces as well. But that's sort of figuring out ways outside of the walls of the institutions to get together. And I think something that maybe is so obvious to all of you who participated in Dogtown College is the political nature of it. It's obvious, but I think it's worth me, younger people, emphasizing that it wasn't just, the things that we were interested in wanting, that you were all interested in wanting to do, but there's a political aspect to it. There's a different way of living and being in the world.
Yes.
And it wasn't, and it had a component. I heard a lot of people talk about the like activist components where you're intervening in the political civic life, but also another part of Occupy that people didn't understand was that it was about embodying the way of living you wanted to do.
Right? That's right.
The media didn't understand that. It's like, what's your agenda? No, our agenda is this way of living.
What we're doing.
The living is our agenda and part of it. And that was not understood even by liberals, right? Even by a lot, in the media. They just didn't understand this thing that wasn't only about making some kind of change through Congress or something, but it was also about actually having a different way of life and modeling that and trying to govern that.
Being the change we want to become.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Well, one of the amazing things is that we got very good attention from the media here. The Gloucester Times really was very positive about what we were doing. We could have been looked upon in some negative ways as a bunch of hapless radicals trying to create an institution. The Times was very embracing of us. They gave us a great deal of publicity. They wrote articles about us. They would always print our announcements about courses and so forth. So it was but also at the time, the Gloucester Times was still a family-run enterprise, and It had a very liberal editor, and it was local. And it was not run by a conglomerate. The Gloucester Times today is owned by a right-wing conglomerate, a right-wing southern conglomerate. It's very different from the Gloucester Times that welcomed Charles Olson's letters and was very welcoming of Dogtown. Yes.
I wanted to ask you another question, Peter, Martin's question sparked something with me,
yes,
too.
Yes, very good.
About the relationship between these alternative ways,
yes,
of living and the way we need to nourish ourselves,
yeah,
with our peers who really just understand the kind of world we want. But then we have to, like you, working with Action. You know, I work in the public schools.
Yes.
This stuff we have with our communities that really get it help nourish us, so then we can kind of launch these involvements with people who don't get it and trying to find the allies there, which is exhausting work. Mm-hmm. You know, bringing progressive education into public schools, mm-hmm, as Kate mentioned, and so like this is just endless battling, and so we need, you know, things like Dogtown College or, mm-hmm, and more informal things. I mean, you know, when I was at the Glass Sailboat and
that's
ready,
right,
to go to become a teacher, you know, I would see you, I would see Garrett and talking about literature while I was supposed to be working for Mac, was like, and talking to Peter and other people,
yep,
you know, it was so nourishing and encouraging. And it was a kind of college, right? It was after college, but I got books from Vincent, shouted them up the street. I would get recommendations from you, from other people, and it was a kind of like extension of college, even though, you know, there wasn't any course registration
and all that sort of thing.
I felt like I got a tremendous education from, you know, so many of the people in this room through the Glass Sailboat. And so there are other ways that it persists too, and ways that are, you know,
well, that's
really
what, that's what community should be.
But this is what Olson wanted,
yeah,
too. I,
yes,
think if you look at the, it's almost like what goes around comes around, because he knew the alleged demise of Black Mountain. There's an exhibit at the ICA now,
yes,
on Black Mountain, and he wanted it to go out in the world. It wasn't
that's
that
right.
It disappeared or anything. It had,
yeah,
incredible resonance and influence through,
yes,
people like Paul Goodman, Buckminster Fuller, and they're still around, and in many ways still coming back uncannily again, because people long for this kind of, I think, direct experience. What Jim's talking about is really important, because I think Olson kind of foresaw that, and he didn't see himself or the school, and in the Duberman's book talks about this as well, as being defeated or ending or anything, but he wanted it to go out into the world and people to carry on in their own particular way.
Well, yes, I mean, those of us who've been involved, yes, Annie?
Oh, I'm just thinking of kind of a full circle thing. I have a friend who wrote that memory and imagination are the same things in different directions, and the importance of holding the narrative, like, which is what the Diggers is all about, and what we're doing is holding the narrative instead of letting it become too diffuse.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, relates to the open space. It's places where you can hold a kind of a shared narrative.
That's extraordinary, because one person can't be expected to remember.
No.
It's collective. It has to be collective.
No, we all experience it through our own lives.
And we experience it in different ways. Getting back to it, and I think, unless you have any more questions, Martin's question is very important. What could be preserved from this experience to come into our lives and institutions? What is it that we could learn that we could make permanent? This was an impermanent experience, and what is there what did we learn in it that could animate and nurture more permanent kinds of institutions? And I think that's extremely important, a sense of direct experience. Yes.
I was thinking when Martin asked, I thought about institutions here in town that have continued and grown,
mm-hmm,
and I went to Pathways and Head Start.
Yes.
And Head Start had one of its pilot programs here. My mother was actually an art teacher in it in the beginning at Plum Cove 50 years ago. And about how the need, you know, talking about the need for certain things continues or evolves, and how the need for Head Start has changed the direction of what they do there, but how essential it is at the same time. And then about how community going in
how sometimes the institutions create an audience for the ideas. Like, we, you know, we go in and we do poetry with them now, with the kids at Head Start, and I think that's part of maybe what we take away from it is that it is our responsibility to share what we know, not to hole up and keep it private, but it's our responsibility to call people out when they're not telling the truth, or to write letters, or to create organizations, or to speak to each other. I mean, it seems simple, but...
Well, I also think, like, the backyard growers is another example of that, too. Yeah, like, people who are, you know, sort of have this other kind of life and nurturing friendships and so on, but then, like, going into the public schools right now and having this, like, you know, garden. Like, this food, yeah, and this, like, garden-to-table kind of thing, you know, farm-to-table kind of program, like, that all the elementary kids now in Gloucester have, right? It's an experience they all get to have. That right, popcorn from the garden, right? They made popcorn, but then the kids all in the school get to have it. So they're the necessity to have. I think, you know, the things that are maybe more outside of those institutions create the energy and they will rise and fall, and with circumstances of life, having children and moving on, relationships and jobs and so on, they'll rise and fall, but they nourish then, we hope, the work that then maybe goes into institutions that are more permanent and lasting. It's just like an ongoing and evolving thing, and constantly having to challenge ourselves to do both parts of it, nourishing our own part, and then also going back into the, sharing that, as Amanda said, sharing it with other people.
Yes, Martin.
I think there might be another rhythm, too, in the long run, which is a kind of alternation of complexity and simplicity, you see. So when energy builds up and it develops all these kind of compartments and ideas and lots of specificity and that kind of thing, but then eventually, even in any creative process, isn't that true? I mean, over the long run, how do you look at your own writing career? Is it getting more complex, or is it getting simpler in a way in its direction? You see?
John Bayliss used to call it entropy. Yes, Peter.
Get back to education. Yeah. And that's what this was. It was a project to, I think, teach people or educate people in some way to lead. I really emphasize that. I mean, that's what education's about. For me, and I came at it because alternate education was a big context within this.
Yes. Place.
Even Harvard had alternate education. Everything was alternate, preceded whatever the subject was, alternate this, alternate that. But I really think in Gloucester, Olson's thing about we are the last first people is so important. And I really think that you've got to frame this place as indigenous in terms of the experience that people have here, or what was available to them, like you're saying, as you did, you were really sharing and teaching, educating in that way, things that were really essential and really validated people's personal and particular experience, and that isn't done in many places.
No,
and certainly not in schools, unfortunately, too much. And that's what's scary about the context that we're in. I think we're still longing for the kind of experience that you provided with the Dogtown College, because it was such an embedded tradition here, and we could draw from that, and hopefully still will, and it'll get stronger as we speak to those longings that I think is so prevalent even in Gloucester now.
I'd like to just say that I don't think we should short sell our schools, because I came out of them.
As did I.
Yeah, we all. Yeah.
As did I. I mean, yeah. No, I mean, we no, I think, you know, you go through that period. You know, I'm a product of the Gloucester Public Schools from kindergarten to grade 12.
I feel like whenever we say that, not that we shouldn't always be working to improve it, but whenever we say that we're not doing it, we're degrading when we are. And there's a lot of people who are working really hard to make sure
that there are leaders coming out of schools and that there is a lot of experience. I mean, that within the structure that they're given, that these things are happening as much as they can. And it's I think that's one of those instances where we shouldn't be making an enemy of somebody. We should be encouraging instead.
No, and I think, though, you know, the point was, our sense was, and it was this national sense, that education had become calcified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In America.
Or teaching to test. I'm not trying to make an enemy.
No.
I'm talking about
and
people are questioning the core curriculum and stuff like that, teaching to test and the MCAS versus, you know, what? I mean, I think that this is where
I'm not saying we shouldn't always be.
But the alternatives had a major impact on American education.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not only the philosophical books that were produced, the Holtz books and Paulo Freire's books, but the alternative schools. When we had the KPN, it was a free school, the KPN Cooperative School. Teachers were sent from the Gloucester Public Schools to observe our classes. They wanted us to go into the public schools and talk to them about what we were doing in the schools. This was very radical. Parents teaching their own children. I remember I taught courses in archaeology and anthropology, and I would take the kids all over the North Shore digging for Indian artifacts, and they never thought about these kinds of things at that time in the public schools.